I'm Spencer.
And I'm Andrew, and you're listening to the At a Distance podcast from The Slowdown. Today we'll be speaking with composer, multimedia artist, and writer Paul D. Miller, who you might know as DJ Spooky.
Paul is the author of several books, including Rhythm Science, Sound Unbound, and The Book of Ice. A social and environmental activist, he was named a National Geographic Emerging Explorer in 2014.
As a champion of science in an age of technologically driven misinformation, Paul has a unique ability to synthesize from multiple sources through his interdisciplinary practice. He offers a perspective that is not only thought-provoking, but also clarifying during this chaotic time. Let's get him on the line. Hi, Paul. Welcome to At a Distance. It's great to have you with us today.
Thanks. I'm speaking to you from the Flatiron Mountains, just north of Boulder, and at the edge of the Rocky Mountains. So yeah, it's a beautiful day here.
Amazing. You were mentioning, normally you live in New York, but you've been out up in the mountains for a bit. How have you been doing through the pandemic?
You know, I was in New York for several months, just kind of kicking it and just doing the ultra isolation kind of scenario in Tribeca. Often my window and my lights would be the only lights on my whole block, like the whole neighborhood emptied out. And it was really fascinating to see that. After a certain point though, when people began to have a lot of the protests and then a lot of the ignoring of social distancing, you know, I was like, you know what? I think I'm going to take a rain check on this and just kind of head it out to Colorado because I have a whole situation out here. Then you get here and then there's huge fires.
Yeah.
The air quality has been just really dramatically reduced by just all the crazy fire stuff. So it's like, my motto this year is I can't breathe, whether it's like a policeman's knee on your neck or whether it's the forest fires that you can't breathe or the pandemic that takes your lungs away. It seems to be sort of a biopolitics year at this point.
Mm. Well, your work broadly, as you've expressed, is about encoded gesture, encrypted psychology. And I'm curious how you see that playing out in this moment.
Well, the world being what it is, I mean, let's just put the cards on the table, so to speak. I mean, we have a situation where the climate is actually, and of course, one could argue that human beings have catalyzed all this disruption and created a radical departure from millions of years of nature's own patterns and systems. And of course, the Anthropocene era being what it is, the human agency, you know, our minds and the world around us have like been, you know, kind of disrupted by hyper-consumerism, capitalism, and above all, a deep irreverence for natural systems around us. So when I say kind of encrypted psychology, I just meant that how people think about the layers of patterns that make up their choices. Now, if you look at encryption, it's usually about hidden signals, being able to have access to ciphers and being able to, above all, to send messages hidden through the noise. So if you're in wartime and you're a general, you're controlling an army, you need to make sure your routes of communication are open. With the kind of the world being what it is right now, we're in this notion of like, kind of like most people are in an era where we're looking at what you call computational propaganda. So one could argue like Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, there's the rule of what you call the social graph. In fact, there's a great new film, so for instance, I just made here in Colorado, actually, called The Social Dilemma, that tracks how social media and other issues are basically have always built a surveillance capitalism model. So when I talk about encrypted psychology, I'm just saying people who want to feel like they have a sense of agency need to understand that you're always engaging with these systems around you. I probably need to make a shorter version of that.
No, and I'm glad you bring up the social dilemma. We had Tristan on recently. We're very much aligned with that thinking. How are you thinking about digital media use right now as we head into the election? What are the things that you're seeing?
Well, my motto at this point is that Trump is basically like Russian malware. You know, the whole notion of how your system can be seized and taken over as a software dynamic. It's interesting because the hardware of our society, infrastructure, the norms that hold democracy together, obviously the Republicans have made a power grab at this point that's similar to what's happened in Germany during the 1920s and 30s with the Weimar Republic. And if you look at the crisis of democracy, one of my favorite writers is a gentleman named Timothy Snyder, and he has a book called On Tyranny. He's literally a historian of tyranny. One of his proteges is David Schimmer, who has a new book called Rigged. And it's a history of election interference. So, yeah, I mean, the tragedy right now is like we're in an era where computational propaganda, like I was saying earlier, everything can be and will be manipulated. And so at the moment, your average person has no idea of this. The coercive power is being leveled at them. So it's heartbreaking when you meet, like, I'm in Colorado, and there's a lot of really friendly and pleasant people. And you'll meet someone who might be an older, I'm just going to do a hypothetical here, like an older white woman, and you're having a pleasant conversation. And she's like, all of a sudden veers into this crazy, you know, quantum wormhole of like, AOC is going to destroy your democracy, and Biden is socialist, and Kamala Harris is communist. And you're like, where are you getting this information? Oh, some friend sent me this on Facebook. And I'm like, okay, gotcha. So next thing you know, you need to figure, how do you deprogram people? Because it actually is neuro-linguistic programming. There's this very specific semiotic relationship to the information people receive from their friends. Facebook obviously is like a sort of a mental contagion, you know. So we're not just facing a pandemic that's based on biology and human disruption of biological systems, but we're facing a pandemic that's based on information disruption. I'll work on saying these in shorter, more soundbite friendly.
No. I love the articulation. You know, it's funny. It's like feeling always beats out thinking, right, for the general public. And you watch OAN News for a second, and it seems like everything's great.
Yeah.
And it seems like things are just moving along. And so how do we also adjust our own narratives to feel better in a way that are on the progressive side that are less combative?
Yeah. I mean, it is about the combative ideas. And the interesting thing is this. We're in an era of weaponized information. In fact, one of the things that I'm out here doing right now is I'm working on my next book, and it's called Digital Fictions, The Future of Storytelling. And I've written, you know, several books over the years, usually with MIT Press, mm-hmm. about technology, the arts, and the sort of the creative economy. And those books are usually taught at university. It's MIT. It's a little bit tech geek oriented. It's been great to see how those books have filtered through the scene and the systems in different ways. But the current book, because the pivot during COVID, everybody is now online. Everyone, you know, is suffering from what I'm calling Zoom fatigue for the moment. You know, it's going to get deeper and weirder as this election process unfolds. You wake up every morning and there's disastrous news, whether it be Ruth Bader Ginsburg dying, crazy fires, more information about the way the virus actually lingers in the body and all sorts of stuff. And people are like blindly following Trump like lemmings going over a cliff. And it's heartbreaking because it makes you feel like your fellow human being is easy to hack. Like you're not just hacking their iPhone, you're hacking their mind. Mm. So the legacy of the 20th century, and this is something that Putin, you know, and the Russian scene, they really have a Cold War mentality. Like they still feel like the world is in binaries. And capitalism, from our point of view here, is it's killed off all other competing economic ideologies. Mm-hmm. But how we organize society right now, you know, it's still based on most people expect the world to, you know, to be the same the next day. They wake up, they go to their job. But the virus this year has totally disrupted everyone's sense of time and their sense of being able to have that continuity. Mm. Schools are instantly shut down when they develop new corona cases. They shouldn't be sending kids to school, by the way. Et cetera, et cetera. Universities, are, you just realize they're a huge hedge fund with a small school attached to it.
Exactly.
And they're just basically, you know, reflections of these kinds of investment environment. The stock market is soaring, but people are being crushed. And so it's like the paradoxes are just, one could go on forever about it at this point.
In your research for Digital Fictions, you were tracking data throughput on the American internet every 60 seconds, which is fascinating. What were some of the things that really surprised you that you found?
Well, say, for example, bandwidth is a really critical issue right now. Like your average video phone call makes a certain amount of data. Obviously, people are not using phones in the same way anymore. And mm-hmm. it's kind of interesting because people are more glued and more addicted to their devices than ever. And again, that's where you're talking about Tristan and his Society for Humane Technology. There's several other really interesting Netflix documentary by Alex Gibney called Agents of Chaos. It's a really good doc about computational propaganda and election hacking. And if you go back to the DNA of stuff like Cambridge Analytica, most people's choices and decisions follow what you call the social graph. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of wild because Twitter, Facebook, all those kind of stuff were based on kind of building a portrait of you that tracks across websites, that tracks across your IP address on your devices. For me as an artist, you got to remember, I'm an artist, I'm not a technician, but I'm very intrigued by these things because it's the art that reflects a different dimension of society that most people are not even engaged with. So it's the power of the invisible. It's the wrath of the math, as somebody like J. Rue the Damager would say in 90s hip hop. And so that kind of thing, it's interesting because it's hard to fight because it's you and it's a reflection of you. But if you think about it's like you're mirror boxing or something and trying to change, you know, these kind of algorithmic portraits of yourself. So even just 60 seconds of what we were just talking about, that was about 60 seconds. There's been millions and billions of messages flying around, images being uploaded, satellites being updated. And I'm speaking to you from a rural area, and hopefully you have reasonably seamless internet. If you hear me clearly, that's because of what you call packet switching. So last year was the 50th anniversary of the internet. I met the gentleman who wrote the source code equations for packet switching. His name's Dr. Leonard Kleinrock. Really fascinating gentleman. And he's, you know, Paul, when we first did the first two hubs of the internet were between UCLA and Stanford Research Institute. And the first message broke the internet at that time. They were trying to type log in, and after typing L and O, the system crashed because there was too much data. Now you fast forward, 50 years later, and the sheer volume of material just your phone generates would have been more than would have been the entire internet at that time. So, you know, these are all just things that keep track of and think about. And there's a legacy of information and society and democracy in crisis that's happening right now. That's kind of where my book has been leading me. In fact, last night I was reading a really interesting article in The Atlantic. Basically, they're using AI now to make articles. And so what's fascinating about that is that you can now think of disinformation becoming infinite. So, you know, just buckle up. It's definitely, my nickname is DJ Spooky. And so the world is catching up. It will all be spooky.
On the subject of the internet, I wanted to bring up that last year you presented Quantopia, the evolution of the internet, at the Yerba Buena Center for the Arts in San Francisco. You did this in collaboration with the Internet Archive. Could you define Quantopia for us and also share sort of how this idea is sort of looking at how the internet has transformed space, time, geography, and to the point you were just making, how we communicate?
Mm-hmm. So people tend to forget. We're now in an era of interdisciplinary arts. I'm using air quotes there. I grew up in Washington, D.C., and both my parents were, well, my dad was dean of Howard University's law school, and my mom was a historian of design. And DuPont Circle at that time, I don't know if you guys know downtown, but the funny thing about the local versus federal, D.C. had a punk scene with bands like Fugazi, Bad Brain, stuff like that. And that lingered over a lot of my thinking about music and disruption and like kind of chaotic sounds and stuff like that. But the internet, amusing enough, most people would not realize that it's been 50 years. They would actually mistake the internet for the web. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to write a project with Internet Archive because they're one of my favorite spaces on the web because they document every day. Like they have this thing called the Wayback Machine. So it documents every web page ever made. And anybody who's an information geek, archive.org is kind of like, they have a relationship with Library of Congress. Like Library of Congress, if you finish a book or a film, or I don't know about how they're archiving podcasts at this point, but basically most creative stuff that you have to have copyright and so on goes to the Library of Congress. So Quantopia, just meant to be like a deep dive into this kind of information world around us and celebrate the 50th anniversary of this crazy, the largest machine human beings have ever made is the internet. So Quantopia just stands for quantified utopia. And it's kind of a funny situation because how we think about utopia, dystopia, obviously this 2020 is probably the most dystopian year in human history. I mean, even the Black Plague and Middle Ages, you know, Renaissance, stuff like that. There's been plagues before. There's been societal collapses. There's been all sorts of stuff. But now with the technologies and the quickness of our time, of how things move, we have an exponential risk of, you know, personally, sometimes I worry about our species even getting out of the 21st century, you know, alive. So Quantopia is that kind of, how should I put this? It's a symphony for the perplexed. It's something that kind of gives you a sensibility of how music is a mirror that we hold up to society. But a society is based on, you know, what some theoreticians now call the network effect. These are things that any composer or artist is going to have to grapple with So I'll give you one funny example. If you're a painter in the Renaissance and you're dealing with the Medici, you know, Da Vinci or, you know, stuff like that, your tools at hand were revolutionized by zero-point perspective, and that you can actually see when painters took the tools of their time and radically changed perspective. Fast forward to 2021, 2020, the revolution is invisible. It's algorithmic-based, and above all, it's hyper-immersive. So if you're a composer and artist, how do you grapple with that? So Quantopia, what I ended up doing was I wrote a symphony based on sort of the evolution of the first points of the internet and the exponential growth of that. Mm-hmm. Then worked with a chorus called the San Francisco Girls Choir and had them sing kind of some of the underlying mathematical material that makes the internet work. So it's this incredible chorus of young girls in San Francisco, and they're singing kind of like these words that ebb and flow between the composites that I made based on the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and information as a human right, and then the math. So it's archived on archive.org. Mm. Yeah, that's it in a nutshell. And again, it's like not just hip hop, not just techno, not just classical, not just electronic. It's a blur of all of those. Mm. And that's, to me, what makes it, you know, we've got to get rid of these 20th century mentality of like the silos. Yeah, I just want to wipe that away.
I wanted to bring up another book of yours, Rhythm Science, from 2004. And in the context of the pandemic and just how many patterns in our lives have been changing, how have you been thinking about rhythm science?
For me, at the moment, graphic design, music, typography, fonts, all of those are tools that can help transform society. And that people don't realize how, like bold or italic or the graphics of the, you know, the way that the layout of the screen that we're looking at right now, those all had to be designed by some brilliant people who were using very limited tools. So rhythm science, for me at least, I wanted to think about graphic design applied to sound. And I'm also a record collector. I've been collecting for a while, but not necessarily normal stuff. I'm always looking for more avant-garde graphics. And there's one gentleman who I always love to bring up, especially to gentlemen like you guys, whose name is Alex Steinweiss. He's generally considered to be the inventor of the record cover sleeve. So in the 1920s and 30s, record cover sleeves used to be blank. And he said, why don't we put an image on the record cover sleeve? So there's kind of a beauty of that because it revolutionized graphic design. You know, just even that little square with an image. Now, if you fast forward to 2020, amusingly enough, Steve Jobs had been a huge fan of applying music and graphic interfaces to, you know, iTunes, stuff like that. And coming out of the ashes of, at that time, you know, it was called Napster. Napster, amusingly enough, set the tone for Spotify, SoundCloud, iTunes, and so on. But those kind of graphics and the interface of music applied to visual, you know, kind of digital media, it really broke open the mold for our time. Like, so whenever you click on an app, that's almost the equivalent of a record cover sleeve. And the way that we think of graphics now is meant to be interactive and things that you engage as a tool. But at the end of the day, it's still the graphics that sort of determine the interface. Mm. Like right now, when we're looking at these squares, I keep thinking of like the Brady Bunch, you know, like the the TV show from way back where all the kids were in those little squares talking to each other. These kind of graphics and other things really condition your response in the 21st century. So that's what that book was about. Mm.
I wanted to bring up William Burroughs, who I've heard you speak about in the past. He seems particularly relevant in this moment. And I was wondering if you've been thinking about him. You know, he was sort of responding to this societal understory of panic and chaos, similar to now, the sort of directionless panic. Yeah. I was curious if you've been thinking about him and also why over time you've found that area so rich.
That's a good one. I mean, nobody wants to live in a bad sci-fi future. My motto these days is let's put the future behind us. Burroughs is one of those writers because he approached everything from a non-linear perspective, what he called the cut-up technique. How much his work influenced my thinking is pretty much foundational. Stuff like, of course, The Ticket That Exploded. There's also, you know, Naked Lunch, which is a classic of the Beat generation. But there's also a really good book by Allen Ginsberg, who was one of his best friends, called The Fall of America. It's a classic epic poem about moving through all these portraits of America in poetry. It's a brilliant book. You know, Burroughs coined the term language is a virus. And he's one of my all-time favorite writers. In fact, I took one of my nicknames from him called The Subliminal Kid. Mm-hmm. So him and William Gibson are two of my all-time favorite writers. But because of the way that they actually hit everything on the nail, like this notion of kind of an alternate universe of language and code. That's something that Burroughs would always kind of keep riffing on. And then the way that language itself affects memory, affects your sense of identity and geography. The term I use these days is the legible landscape. Mm. Burroughs got it. Like, he just somehow was on point pretty much across the board. Right now, we're in an era where most people's sense of reality is almost a science fictional relationship at this point. Mm-hmm. And again, Burroughs, he set the tone for so much of this stuff. And again, other beat poets and writers like Amiri Baraka, Allen Ginsberg. In fact, I have a book of, I'm actually putting a music piece together now based on Ginsberg's book. It's called The Fall of America. Mm. It's seriously powerful stuff. And these guys, they were living in a different era that just somehow, I mean, our era has its problems, but you know, you have to imagine how powerful it must have been to be an avant-garde poet at that time. What do you think of it?
I mean, I'm a huge fan. And when I got to New York in the mid-90s for art school, I mean, Ginsberg was still around. And, you know, I had an art school teacher who did the Complete Outsider, the film on Paul Bowles, and really got a great education at that time. I don't think people are really looking at that material now. But I've been thinking a lot about these people who had the will and the courage to see clearly at a time that, you know, misinformation was almost as powerful as it is now. Hmm. You know, there wasn't as much information, but the truth was very, very hard to see at the time.
Right.
And I think they were projectively seeing the truth and sharing it poetically so that people could feel it. And so I'm always looking for that. And I'm always interested in artists who are making work now who are inspired by that work, which is why we brought it up.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's actually Burroughs' legacy lingers over this whole pandemic situation. And we're in this era of disinformation, like you're saying. I mean, people have always used disinformation. It's something that's part of the political process. I actually met Ginsberg and visited Burroughs' house in Lawrence, Kansas. Amusingly enough, everything you were just saying, it's now part of the basic foundation of the political discourse. Mm-hmm. So Mitch McConnell could easily be a character in a William S. Burroughs novel.
Totally, totally. He looks like one.
Yeah, he's Agent K-9.
Yeah, exactly.
You've been long speaking about and advocating around climate issues, so I wanted to bring that up. In what ways do you think the conversations around COVID-19 kind of connect to what's happening on our planet? I mean, obviously, you're feeling it quite directly with the fires in Colorado.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, climate change is a reflection of the Anthropocene. There's no question. When I say the Anthropocene, meaning climate science studies that most scientists would agree is based on human agency. The problem right now is that you have belief versus science, which is still going back to that kind of crazy dark ages. I mean, you know, like people have theological discussion of how many angels dance on the head of a pin if you're, you know, a couple hundred thousand years ago. And you could be burned at the stake for saying, oh, I don't know, that the earth circles around the sun. You know, so if you're Galileo or Johannes Kepler, you know, all of these guys were threatened with excommunication or death for saying a simple thing like the earth circles the sun. To me, it's that obvious. Like, we are in an era of climate change. The problem with the right wing is they are like people who with their heads buried in the sand, like an ostrich. And the fires are not going to go away because you don't believe in them. There's a problem with the right wing is they don't care until it affects them. So when the fires or floods happen, the first people to cry for government help and the first people to try and get those benefits are they going to be the right wing lunatics who've then cut your taxes, cut any access to Medicare, and have been horribly vicious about it, access to basic things like medical care for people who have been confronting all these bills. Now, the COVID thing is a funny thing because it's like Trump running around as a delusional lunatic. He's still a reflection of a very specific 30% of the American populace. And the heartbreaking thing is those people, you know, they're going to his rallies. They are willing to suspend democracy, mainly to just play in the ashes of what they view as white supremacy. Mm. When I say the ashes, because the narrative's already moved on. These guys just don't get it. Mm-hmm. And so because of that, they are the last gasp of kind of a dead narrative of the late 20th century. You know, if you say stuff like that in China, the virus isn't real, you know, good luck with that. You know, or if you say climate change isn't real, then most parts of the world that are, it's the people who've produced the least amount of carbon are going to be smashed by the actions of the wealthiest people on the planet. Mm. So these are all things that linger over the conversation. It's that paradox of hyperconsumption, that paradox of misinformation. These fires are just a reflection of the same issues that are underlying the COVID thing. It's like disruption of natural systems. Mm. So,
yeah.
And yes, it's real. The virus doesn't care if you believe in it or not. And the fires don't care if you believe in them or not. And the planet still circles the sun. You know, and these right-wing lunatics running around. I'm like, you know, if you don't believe in it, why don't you go live in the middle of one of these fires? Or, right. You know, why don't you, you know, go to a Trump rally and then, like, you know, I'm sure it's a tragedy of the moment. But that when Herman Cain died, for example, after going to a Trump rally, you know, I have no love for Herman Cain's political ideologies. But, you know, he didn't believe in the viral issues. And
yeah,
these are things that they don't care if you believe in them or not. They will happen if you don't think about science as that basic tool that we have. This tool that's an incredible tool called science.
I
mean, just
I wanted to mention art in the context of science, similar to, you know, how we look at science and use data to understand climate change. I'm wondering, do you think audio, sound, music, art can become an equally or at least as powerful a way of comprehending and communicating some of the issues?
Absolutely. We need to make science sexy. And that's, I think your average kid gets that. And they think, yo, man, I'm playing a video game. People are doing crazy stuff in that game. There's science. I get it. Or if your kid is on TikTok or somebody's doing stuff. I believe the good news out of all of this, and this is the lining of the silver cloud, is having been confronted with the conflict between belief and science, belief loses every time. So people are really going to have to up their game and look at science as that foundation for a better future. And the countries that are coping best with all this COVID, amusing enough, are run by women. Mm-hmm. Whether you look at, like, New Zealand, for example, has been really, they've done an incredible job managing this stuff.
Germany.
But an engagement with science is what will help us get through this all. And again, if you don't engage with science, the virus doesn't care. And like the red states that all these people are running around with no masks and they're protesting, going to Target saying, I don't want to wear a mask. And there's all sorts of what you call Karen videos. I'm sure you got the Karens.
Karens go wild.
Yeah. And they're just kind of like, you know, these people, I don't want to wear a mask. And they'll go to like a shopping center and scream at somebody like at a Target or go to Trader Joe's and say, you know, and knock over a stand of stuff saying, you know, I don't want to wear a mask and you have to let me in the store. You're depriving me of my rights. Watch any of these videos. The common denominator is that these are wildly selfish people who are in a delusional state about their relationship to society.
Absolutely.
As a matter of fact, wearing a mask is, I think, the most respectful thing you can do because nobody knows if you're sick or if the other person's sick mm-hmm. or anything.
There was a great column in the Times, I think, this weekend in the ethics column that talked, someone said, I took part in the trial. I have the vaccine. Do I need to keep continuing wearing a mask? And the answer was ultimately yes, because now it's a social contract to wear a mask. You're saying I support, mm-hmm. even if you have no way you could get sick. Not that that's true, but it's about a projection of the social contract and a care for others. Before we let you go, one final question. As we do emerge from this moment, COVID, we won't be emerging from the climate crisis quite as quickly, but as we emerge from COVID and things start to open up, what's your greatest hope?
Huh. That's an optimistic note. My greatest hope is that we will come out of this. I don't think it's going to be next year. It's probably going to be 2 or 3 years. And any vaccine that they do come up with and rushing for the election or Putin calling, I don't know if you heard about this Russian vaccine called Sputnik 5. I'm like, yeah, you put that in your veins. Right. Go for it. You know, I'm not going to mess with that stuff for a quick minute. But I do feel that I'm someone who's very into science. I'm very respectful of vaccines and immunization. There's going to be a critical moment where people are going to be confronted with this kind of almost superstitious fear that's been inspired by the right wing to do a self-reflection. Like they're going to be like, hey, maybe there's a moment where I really should think, you know, my grandma died or my father. There's one woman who was a right winger. Her dad died. And she said the only preconditioned situation my father had was he believed in Trump.
That was the comorbidity.
Yeah.
Was that the belief in Trump.
Yeah. And so these people have to open their heart and mind up to the fact that science is real. And beliefs are going to have to really engage with that. And I think the takeaway from all of this is that we've had a short, sharp lesson in science in the last several months. Bioscience, information science, data science, all of these things, you know, mathematically speaking, are about exponential growth. Like the virus is a logarithmic curve and its ability to spread, and the air molecules and the people talking about the science of the masks. So I think we'll have a better engagement with science as a sort of a pan-humanist thing. And people will be like, it's not about black, white, Latino, rich or poor. I mean, regretfully, the poorest people are being hammered by the virus. They're being hammered by climate change. Maybe it'll build a little more empathy. I mean, right now, the Trump demographic, I've just written those people off at this point. I'm sorry to keep looping on that, but, you know, going to a rally in the middle of this, it's like these are what you call like Nuremberg hillbillies, you know, like, you know, the Nuremberg trial, you know, mm-hmm. Nuremberg rallies. You know, these people, you know, it's just like basically a hillbilly rally where Trump is a carnival barker. You know, it's heartbreaking to see people. You're like, this is my fellow human beings. It is 2020. How do we get people to just move past that? But the right wing, I have to admit, they won't engage with this stuff until it affects them. So we'll see. And hopefully we'll come out of this as a better nation and a more empathetic nation as the legacy of misinformation and other issues. Hopefully, you know, make people realize this is, it's about being human. So that's my greatest hope.
Paul, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts with us today. This is really beautiful.
And thanks.
Thanks for listening. To hear more episodes of At a Distance, you can find us on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or Stitcher. You can follow us on Instagram at slowdown.tv. To sign up for our weekly newsletter, Exploring the Five Senses, head to our website at www.slowdown.tv.